From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. From detentions to suspensions to expulsions, the issue of school punishment is nothing new. But data shows there's been a sharp rise in the use of tasers by school police or resource officers in recent years. We'll talk with Huffington Post education editor Rebecca Klein about her investigation into the use of tasers on kids. She says there's a greater risk the younger the person is who gets tased.
They have a warning saying that you should refrain from using these weapons on children if you can. Small children, it is more likely to cause cardiac arrest, which can obviously be fatal. In addition, tasers, they have the effect of making you fall down. And if you're a child, that can, you know, there's one case of a kid, he ended up in a coma for a number of months after falling down.
That's coming up. First, though, yesterday we talked about the sale of Athens-based Terrapin Beer Company to beverage giant Miller Coors. Atlanta writer Jim Varel is unhappy with that development.
It's a question of beer politics, honestly, and not wanting your favorite local brewery to be owned by a company that is actively lobbying against other craft breweries in your state.
Here are your first thoughts. Sam Burnham, who's often with us on The Break Room, says craft beer is local. It allows us to visit exotic places, meet interesting people, and drink all their beer. Also on Twitter, Michael Ruffin says, I wish it hadn't happened, but if a hopsecutioner is still delicious, I'll still drink it. And Leek K wants to know, let's hear the benefits to beer consumers whose favorite breweries have sold out in recent years. Models have changed since the 90s. We always love to get your opinion. It doesn't matter if you call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457 or tweet us like they all did. It's at OST Talk. You can also post to Facebook and we might feature your comments on the show. The U.S. textile industry employed more than a million workers in the middle of the 20th century, but hundreds of factories, mostly in the South, have closed their doors since then. Now, a retired Georgia Tech professor thinks he can bring at least a few of those jobs back to the U.S. using a robot, specifically a robotic sewing machine. Joining me now is Barry Clark. He's Vice President of Research and Development at Software Automation. That's Soft, W-E-A-R, Automation. Good morning, Barry.
Good morning.
Why is it difficult? I mean, it's 2016. You would think we already had robots sewing clothes. Why don't we?
That's a great question. There's been a lot of attempts to automate sewing in the past, but the problem has always been the flexibility of fabric. That's why we like to wear it. It conforms well to our body. But unlike something like steel that's very easy to work with and manufacture, fabric distorts, and that's always made it very difficult to actually automate the sewing process.
It moves around and it stretches.
That's right.
Okay, so here is that Georgia Tech professor emeritus, Steve Dickerson. He's explaining how well robots usually do with metal, as you mentioned.
The most common method that seemed to come close to working was to take the fabric and, let's say, starch it very severely so that, in fact, it became like a piece of sheet metal.
You don't have to do that with this new robot, right?
That's right. So we focus on using computer vision to actually keep track of the fabric.
Cameras. You put a whole bunch of cameras on the robot.
That's right. So we have all, like, many, many cameras, right? 3, 4, 5 cameras that are looking at the fabric from different angles. And what that allows us to do that hasn't been done in the past is actually keep track of where the fabric is so that if it distorts, if something bad happens, then the robot can actually correct for that while it's sewing.
The robot is keeping track or someone else is watching it on a camera?
The robot itself. So the robot is not only the hands, but the eyes, so to speak.
And how fast does that happen? I mean, if it's, let's say a fabric snags,
right?
How quickly does the robot recognize that it snagged?
Well, so when you're sewing, you're doing basically 30, you're putting the needle into the fabric 30 times a second. And so that means that the cameras are actually taking 1,000 frames a second, looking at that fabric, translating that into some sort of instructions for the robot, and then actually moving the fabric somewhere between 20 and 30 times a second.
But we're not at the place yet where I can put a bunch of denim onto the table and have the robot sew me a pair of jeans.
That's correct. So we're doing a lot of different operations in factories for denim.
Yeah.
But our general approach was kind of crawl to walk to run. So we're in a lot of factories for home goods, flat goods, things that are 2D operations.
Yeah, like a curtain.
That's exactly right, yeah. And so then we're moving forwards towards manufacturing a whole garment.
Okay, so let me bring you into this, Courtney, academic director of the fashion department at the Art Institute of Atlanta, and he wrote a book on the history of fashion. It's good to have you as well, Courtney.
Thank you.
What difference does it make where something is sewn? A lot of garment jobs have moved overseas where labor is much cheaper. Does that matter?
Actually, I do. I think just because cheap does not mean that it's better. I believe, and I am a true advocate, that we should employ our own, but I also think that fashion is such a universal language that we could really partner with everyone and ask you to get the job done, because now a passport can get you anywhere, but at the end of the day, a skill set can open the door for many. So in my opinion, technology, and I salute Barry and the software automation team, because how I really equate it is the new, the now, the next. And so to answer your question in a nutshell, where is it made? Yes, it truly matters. But if you have skill sets that are teachable, I think anyone can be taught. And I think those are the skill sets that we teach here at the Art Institute.
How important, Courtney, is it for, say, a clothing manufacturer to be present when something's made? And I'm thinking of, you know, the very old standards like Levi Strauss and revolutionizing denim. Does that matter in the process of being there, watching a garment being made, being part of how it is made? Does that matter to a designer?
Actually, yes, because I think at the end of the day, a designer is the creative, but they also want to have every aspect of involvement when it comes from creation to finalization of their product. So does that mean that they're going to see every step or every nuance? No, but they're going to actually see the final product. But when it's actually on a body or when it's in a store being sold, that's the end result. And so at the end of the day, that's still their name. So whoever they partner themselves with, because we all know it takes a team to get something done.
Yeah.
The larger the team or the more subsidized the team is, the better the product and the end result will be.
We'd love to hear from our listeners. And I wonder if you look at the labels to see where a piece of clothing has been made and whether you're more likely to buy a clothes that say made in the U.S. You can tweet us at OST or join the conversation on Facebook. My guests are Courtney Hammonds. He's academic director for the Art Institute of Atlanta's Fashion Department and also software vice president of R&D, Barry Clark. And that's soft, W-E-A-R. Let's hear another comment from the Georgia Tech professor who designed this robot or helped design it, Steve Dickerson, actually says that having these robotic sewing machines will change what a factory looks like.
If you took the broad picture and looked at the factory production floor, the only thing that would be different is very few people, if any.
Okay. So I mentioned that this could bring a few jobs back to the U.S., but the point of this robot is that you don't have to have a bunch of people sitting at a sewing machine, right, Barry?
That's exactly correct.
So how many people does it take to operate one of these robots?
So right now we think of, techs essentially operating kind of a group of robots at once.
Mm-hmm.
And so the general numbers we use for that are somewhere between kind of 3 and 4 robots per person. But the important thing to realize is really everywhere, not only in the United States, manufacturers are having a lot of trouble finding labor to sew. So even if you look at overseas, the quality of labor and the kind of the desire to sew just isn't there as people move to cities and look at more skilled jobs to kind of improve their situation and make more money. So really the automation is, it's not only kind of a good financial thing, but it's a necessity if we want to continue to kind of manufacture in the quantities that they do today.
Courtney, what is your response to having robots sew things? Look, the world has moved away from the culture in which so many people were able to sew things for themselves, but the robot may take us further away even from that. What's your response to that?
Well, my answer is going to be twofold, and clearly mine is going to come from a different angle because we're teaching the new creatives of tomorrow to actually sew and be productive. But I think at the end of the day, the other side of that is how I can appreciate this brand is that it's really teaching and pushing creatives such as my students and the new designers of the future to think differently because at the end of the day, sometimes they do not have the disposable income to pay for a lot of labor. So if they were able to partner with a brand such as this, they're able to get things done in a more effective manner. But the other side of that is, I think what we cannot do is dispel the creative genius and the creative art of a professional that actually learns how to do the craft of their own. Because as we all know, and clearly I'm not dispelling the creativity of this new product, but technology does go down. So sometimes if it was to go down, what is your next result? And so the next result will be to actually do it by hand or do it with a
right, if the robot breaks.
Yeah, and so and clearly that's the prayer that it does not go down. But I think you have to look at both sides of the coin because at the end of the day as well, I think going back to 2014, there was an 8% increase in manufacturing jobs, not just in Atlanta, but just in the United States alone. And that came from a 2014 grant, actually through Georgia Tech and Walmart, $2 million. And it really helped fund Crafted. And that's just an organization when you're talking about the apparel fabrication and technology.
Yeah.
And you have those type of organizations, and you then have higher education programs such as ours and others as well that really teach and train professionals to go out there in the industry. But still, again, giving kudos to this emerging brand, be able to partner with them so they can take their thought processes to the next level.
So, Barry, what are the at this point, you're mostly sewing, as you said, flat pieces. Let's take a curtain that's sewed by your robot as opposed to a curtain that's already sewed by somebody sitting at a large industrial sewing machine. Do we have a comparison of quality?
Yeah, so we are we can sew within plus or minus about a 16th to a 32nd of an inch. So we're right on par with kind of the highest quality sewers that are out there today.
And reproduced the same way.
That's right.
Over and over.
Really, our largest benefit is that we're consistent. Right. And so that kind of whatever we're sewing, that's what we're going to sew throughout the entire process. And that allows if there is an issue, right, you're going to see that issue in every single piece. And then you can actually tune that out. But the benefit of the vision, the cameras looking at the fabric, it really gives us that kind of improved accuracy on every single piece.
But we won't see full deployment until they can sew a shirt.
That's right. So that's actually something that we're working on designing right now, and we're looking to work with someone to release that kind of in the next 18 months.
In the next 18 months. That is Barry Clark. He's Vice President of Research and Development at Software Automation. Based in Atlanta, it developed the automatic sewing machine. Courtney Hammonds is Academic Director of the Fashion Department at the Art Institute of Atlanta. Courtney and Barry, thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just ahead, schools are using stun guns on kids as young as kindergarten age. Is that a necessary punishment, or does it go too far? First, though, why are there so many rape kits in Georgia that have gone untested? This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. A new report shows the Georgia Bureau of Investigations is currently dealing with nearly 3,500 backlogged rape kits. Healthcare professionals are required to submit those kits to authorities if a sexual assault victim requests it. The political satire TV show Full Frontal with Samantha Bee recently looked at the backlog of untested rape kits around the country. And here's the host, Samantha Bee.
Now for more comedy. Rape kits! A traumatizing, invasive medical procedure for collecting evidence and then collecting dust as they sit around untested for years.
Bee targeted Georgia in particular.
Despite passing unanimously in the House, the Pursuing Justice for Rape Victims Act will never reach the Senate floor. That from Senator Renee Unterman. She chairs the committee that killed it.
If there was a problem, I would be Johnny on the spot, and I would have written the legislation.
Excuse me, I just have to consult my feminist rule book. Oh, here we are. No rape jokes, and don't be mean to other women. Woman, have you lost your f***ing mind?
Joining me to talk about this is Atlanta native Jo Miller. She is the executive producer of Full Frontal with Samantha Bee. Good morning.
Good morning.
And I guess I should start with congratulations, because Full Frontal is racking up awards and doing very well.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Yeah, we won a TCA, Television Critics Association Award, which we, in the office, we call it the Teen Choice Award. And we are, our writing staff is nominated for an Emmy.
An Emmy.
First.
That's so. Right. So congratulations.
Thank
first.
You.
But tell me about the focus on Georgia. And this is not the first time that Samantha and the show has gone after Renee Unterman. Is that because of you, because you're Atlanta native, or did something else bring that to the staff's attention?
Well, this one, I thought you might ask me that, so I went back and looked in our records to figure out how this one came up, because our office is very collaborative, and people just send stories to our central email list from all over. And I looked back, and it looks like it was in March, and I had found it in the Brookhaven, Georgia Post, the story. But rape kits were already on our radar because we were following Jean Shaheen's federal law through the Senate, where it passed unanimously. So when this came up in Georgia, we tend to find stories from places that have very good, strong local investigative journalism. And I want to give a shout out to 11 Alive, because Channel 11 does great journalism, and they have done a lot on Senator Unterman, and I encourage people to go look it up.
Well, you're not the only. John Oliver has also shouted out to local reporters in terms of being a place where he pulls a lot of his information from. When you say that you rely on good local reporting, how often do you end up with a subject where there is no local reporting to rely on? I mean, how crucial is that relationship?
Well, it's pretty crucial, even if there's just a little bit, to start us off and start digging. And if there's a gap, then we can call people, we can call legislators ourselves, and try and learn more about the issue. But without local reporting, nobody is going to learn anything. You know, the national media rely on local reporting as well. So it's to the extent that local reporting is still surviving and still funded, they are heroes.
So when you approach a story like Rape Kits, and you say it was already on your radar, how do you go about making that funny? Or I guess I should say, how do you go about cracking jokes about rape kits without crossing a line?
I mean, what's not funny about rape? I mean, in this case, it's the absurdity of how many bipartisan unanimously passed bills are there? Not many. And to have something that is so bipartisan as reform of the criminal justice system and the way that it treats forensic evidence and the way that it treats victims of sexual assault, everyone agrees. And when one person stands up and throws a wrench in it, that's absurd. So the absurdity is there. And our comedy is, well, you can probably tell, a way that we work out our disbelief and anger and incredulity over a subject. It just comes out as comedy, and we had a lot of disbelief and anger about this.
Yeah, and I want to play a clip that seemed to send Samantha Bee into fits, I should say. Idaho Sheriff Roland Garland was featured in your segment.
I believe the legislature needs to take a strong look at allowing law enforcement to do their job and not try to dictate what we need to do. They need to let us decide if we're going to send the kid in and when we send the kids in. The majority of our rapes that are called in are actual consensual sex. It's a 17-year-old girl, and she had consensual sex with her boyfriend but didn't know how to tell her parents. What does it do to her partner?
How do you think, in terms of tone, what makes Full Frontal different in the way you react to stories like this and the way you write about them?
We cuss a lot.
Well, there's that.
Every show is different because of the voice of the hosts and the writers, and our voice is, at least the way people write about it, Sam's voice is a little raw and unfiltered, and as I was saying before, we kind of take our pain and voice it in comedy. Like that right there, that is the Idaho sheriff, right?
Yeah.
Very representative of problems within police departments. This is a universal problem which is not addressed by the bills that have passed about rape kits. I think only like 7 out of 100 rape cases are pursued. And there's particular a culture of disbelief in a lot of law enforcement around reports, especially when it is poor women or women of color, or when the rapist is someone known and not a stranger. There's what he said about, oh, it's just consensual sex that somebody later regretted. That represents the beliefs of a lot of people in law enforcement, and so there's a lot of cultural change that needs to happen in law enforcement and education to get justice for survivors of sexual assault.
Yeah, that is Jo Miller. She's the executive producer of Full Frontal with Samantha Bee, an Atlanta native. Samantha Bee's show is on TBS. Jo, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
The reason there are so many rape kits is that rape is an all-too-common crime. 107 seconds from now, someone will be sexually assaulted in the U.S., and then 107 seconds after that, and then 107 seconds later. That's all according to federal data analyzed by the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network. And that statistic shocked Atlanta artist Jessica Caldas. So this past April, she took to the city streets with a piece of chalk and an important message. She marked the ground with an X every 107 seconds to represent those affected by sexual violence. I met with Jessica Caldas in April on the Atlanta Beltline near Krog Street Market, and I asked about her art and how this project has helped her deal with her own past as a victim of sexual abuse.
A huge part of my work is talking about things that are stigmatized in really casual ways, because my belief is that the conversation around them, having those conversations, is sort of what creates opportunity for change. People don't understand things like sexual assault or domestic violence very well because they're things that people don't talk about regularly. So my belief there kind of helped me get to a point where I did feel comfortable talking about my own rape in a public way. And it all kind of came to a head this spring with the rape kit bill that was being held up in the Senate. So
that's the bill in which they were trying to go ahead. Just so our listeners know, her watch is going to go off every 107 seconds and she's going to make an X. So this is the bill that would have tried to get through the backlog of rape kits that are sitting stored in various police departments.
I actually lobbied with the Georgia Women's Policy Institute to help get it voted on before on sign day, and it got passed at like midnight.
And it's too bad that this isn't TV, because people would see that you're beaming.
It was incredible.
Which is the part that's making you so happy? Is it the fact that these rape kits, I mean, it has to be more than just that they're going to get tested.
And it doesn't mean that every kit's going to get tested. What the bill does is it just provides procedure and a way to count and kind of make accountable the whole process. I think what makes me so happy is that I took this, what felt like a big chance for myself to like share my story in a really public way, for something I believed in, but that I was very nervous about, and it kind of paid off. I've never felt so strong in my ability to actually change things. So I got to participate in policy and the legislative process, and I got to share this story and talk about it in a super public way, and people were very supportive and very excited, and all of that is just like, it just kind of, it's hard not to feel really good about it. So.
Do you think what you're doing now, and we have how many marks so far since you've been in? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 marks just since you've been standing here.
Yeah.
Do you consider this to be performance art?
It is a kind of performative work, yeah. It's also, I call it social practice, because where I really hope the art happens is in the conversation. So far, no one's really stopped to talk to us, and that happens. But
people do stop and talk and ask you why you're making a mark.
Yes. But even if they don't talk, yes, there is a performative aspect to it. Honestly, the basic goal of the project is to honor all of these victims. I mean, to me, 107 seconds is dismal. It's a dismal number to hear, especially in a place like the United States, and we kind of pride ourselves on being so progressive or so great. But I know the truth is that we have a lot of work to do on a lot of the issues that I care about. So,
I mean, the U.S., even at a federal level, has been talking about and trying to address sexual assault for decades. Mm-hmm. And yet here we are still talking about a pervasive rape culture. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you believe we do have a rape culture and why it persists.
I do believe that there is a rape culture that persists in the U.S. I think that it's changed more in the past few years than I've seen. I've also just been paying attention a lot more probably in the past few years than I did before. But, you know, the White House, and there are politicians making really clear public effort to fight sexual assault. I think the ability for people to share stories in really public ways, social media is a huge, powerful tool for this. And I think people are just like,
well, I got, you know, just to push back a little bit, yeah. Social media, some people say, is actually perpetuating and strengthening rape culture, that because of all the cyberbullying, because right. of those private forums on 4chan and other places.
That's so what I think what happens is if there's like sort of private spaces where people can then reinforce each other's beliefs and ideas about what rape is or what consent is or what is, you know, sexual about a woman or not, then yes, that's going to reinforce that culture. But also then what you have is people speaking out more broadly and publicly about these things and about how wrong those things are. So when somebody gets cyberbullied, there's actually a really incredible organization that's been created in the past year called Heart Mob. And it's basically an organization that's fighting to correct cyberbullying and to protect the people that speak out on these issues and to provide ways to protect yourself when you do speak out online and to kind of like to deal with that issue. And I think that's a huge deal. Like, I don't know that something like that would have existed 5 years ago. So I'm pretty excited about things like that. And I think any space is going to have people that are not good, and that and I think ultimately you're going to deal with that in almost any space, whether you're online or you're in public, if you're in a city or if you're in the country or wherever, it's going to happen. So it's just knowing how to talk to people and being unafraid, I think, to engage and to be wrong or to be challenged. I mean, I get challenged a lot with the work I do, but I'm never quite afraid of it. I kind of always expect it, and therefore I get to have these great conversations with people. And being willing to talk to people, to provide an opportunity for education or awareness that maybe they wouldn't have experienced, is like, that's my bread and butter. I love it.
What's the most common question you get when people stop? I mean, other than what are you doing, which I assume is the first question.
Yes.
But what's the most common question after that?
People want to know a lot about statistics around reporting and prosecution, which are pretty dismal. So.
And yet there's a persistent myth that a large number of rapes are just women who regret having sex.
Right. That's a part of the rape culture that exists in our society, the lack of understanding of the nuances of consent. And, you know, I think some people would consider a lot of experiences I hear as being just like nights that somebody made a drunken mistake, but that's not reality. But that's a kind of an education thing. I'm a big believer in education as like another avenue for change. I think that sex education is really important, and not just talking about sex, but talking about consent and boundaries and healthy relationships, because I think all of that ties into our understanding of how we treat each other and how we express and understand empathy, and thus essentially how we eventually get to consent and understanding, like how to treat each other in sexual ways as well.
That's Atlanta artist Jessica Caldas. She spoke with me on the Beltline earlier this year. You can see pictures of Jessica's month-long campaign at gpbnews.com.
rape.org. Coming up next, cops often use tasers in the course of their work, but should schools use them on kids? This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. Tomorrow, we welcome three Southern comedians back to Georgia. The Sick of Stupid tour aims to counteract some stereotypes that are out there about people in the South. And we wonder if you've ever been stereotyped as a Southerner. What did they assume about you, and what was it like to be subject to that? You can call us at 404-500-9457 to be part of the discussion, and be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. About a year ago, a fight broke out outside Rockdale County High School in Conyers, Georgia. A Conyers police officer approached and fired his taser. Both students instantly dropped to the ground. There was an amateur video recording made, and in it you can hear the popping sound from the taser.
Stay right.
That incident at Rockdale County High School was the second within 3 years that involved a taser. It was also one of more than 80 cases over the past 5 years nationwide of school-based police officers using tasers on K through 12 students. They were tracked for a recent story from the Huffington Post and the Hessinger Report, which is a nonprofit news agency that covers education. Joining me from New York is Rebecca Klein. She's the education editor at the Huffington Post and worked on that story. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Rebecca, how difficult was it to get this information? Because as I understand it, schools don't actually collect the information and or make it public.
Yeah, so basically the only way that we were able to get this information, which I might add, we believe is a gross underestimation that there's likely many, many more cases of this happening that we are just unaware of. We tracked local news reports of this happening since September 2011, but that is dreadfully unsystematic.
Right. In other words, in order for you to find it, it had to have been reported somewhere in a paper or on TV.
Exactly. Right.
So why do you think that this is a gross underestimation of the number of incidents?
So police officers who are based in school are the ones who are tasering students. So oftentimes a school isn't tracking how often it's happening. That information is collected by the local police department, which employs these school-based police officers. And they don't differentiate between when this happens on the street to an adult versus when this happens to a child in school. So all that information is likely lumped together for a local police department. So that means that there aren't individual schools tracking how often this is happening in their own schools. States aren't tracking it, and the federal government isn't tracking it. So we really have no idea what the actual number is.
So is there any standard that requires a school to keep track? Or I assume there are standards that say a school has to notify a parent when this has occurred.
Yeah, so I would assume that a school has to notify a parent when this occurs, when their child is being taken to the hospital, things of that nature. But there's no standard that says they have to track how often uses of force are being used against their students.
Let me bring Ziyan Tseng into this conversation. He's a professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Hi, Ziyan.
Hi, good morning. Glad to be here.
It's good to have you. Can you explain what happens to a human body when it's hit by a taser?
Yeah, so first, for your listeners to understand, a taser can be deployed in two ways. One is can be shot from a distance where the barbs are deployed and can contact the subject from a distance of about 6 feet, and then there's what's called drive stun, where the taser is applied directly to the skin. There is a very real, albeit small, risk of cardiac arrest with a taser application, which a way to think about it is a controlled electrocution, where you're applying these pulses of 50,000 volts of electricity directly to the body, and the current from the taser can directly overtake the heart rhythm and cause cardiac arrest in certain situations.
Is it similar to the technology used for, say, paddles in a hospital to restart someone's heart?
It is. In a simplistic fashion, it is, but you're applying direct current, whereas for defibrillation pads, it's a very controlled timing of the electricity at a precise moment in the cycle of the heart to restart it. But you can think of a defibrillator as potentially an antidote to a cardiac arrest that might be caused by a taser.
But the manufacturer of these tasers, almost all the tasers are manufactured by Taser International. Zian, the manufacturer does not recommend their use on children. Why does it matter whether you're using a taser on a child or an adult?
Yes, it's a good question. So as I mentioned, for the taser to overtake the heart rhythm and cause cardiac arrest, the current has to reach the heart. And in a child, of course, the distance between the chest wall to the heart is much smaller than in an adult. For that matter, in a small person, such as a petite woman, would also be at higher risk for a taser-induced cardiac arrest. For that reason, and for I'm sure your other experts might discuss this as well. Taser applications on children are to be avoided.
Rebecca, in your analysis of statistics from the Department of Education, you found that 17% of public schools have equipped security personnel with tasers. Is that accurate?
Yeah, as of 2010.
Which is a rise from the years before.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Why are more schools buying them? Why are they equipping more of their security personnel with them? And why do they say they need them?
So I can assume that that's because tasers have become increasingly popular for police departments in general. As I said earlier, the police officers who are in school are oftentimes just regular police officers, and this is just where they're assigned to be. So they carry all the same weapons that they would if they were in any other place or community on the street. A vast, vast majority nowadays of police departments have electroshock weapons like tasers, and they just carry them over into the schools.
We would love to hear from our listeners on how you feel about the deployment of tasers against kids in K-12 schools. You can tweet us at OST Talk. You can also join the conversation on Facebook. My guests are Rebecca Klein, education editor at The Huffington Post. Jian Sang is a cardiologist and electrophysiologist at the University of California, San Francisco. And let's welcome David Osher to the conversation, vice president and institute fellow of the American Institutes for Research. Hi, David.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
So Zian was talking about the medical, the physiological effects of a taser on a kid's body. What do we know about the emotional effects of a kid after they've been tased at school?
Well, what we know from the few studies that have been done is the fact that it has a traumatic effect on some young people. You know, they can feel overwhelmed, and that can lead to emotional debilitation. It can increase levels of anxiety. And at the same time, it can actually affect cognitive functioning as well, at least for the short run. And that's not surprising, because when you're anxious, we also know that it affects things like working memory.
How might it affect trust between a child and their teacher and their administrators at the school?
Yeah. Everybody responds differently, but at the same time, both for young people who are tased as well as some of the young people who see others being tased, that it can really affect trust of adults. It can affect trust of people in authority. It can affect trust of the environment, all of which can then really affect whether or not people can engage in the learning process and whether or not they can engage in school.
Rebecca, for the incidents that you found, and again, there were 84 in the past 5 years or so, what were the reasons why the child was tased? What was the infraction that the kid had, I guess, committed before they got tased?
It ran the gamut. It could be students engaging in a physical altercation. It could be students talking back to their teachers and being unruly. It could be students putting their hands on a school-based police officer. It could be students who were resisting police officer who was trying to suspend them or something of that nature. It really varied.
And Zian, I read comments from police officers saying that tasers in the end make things safer. That's something I absolutely understand coming from when it's involving two adults. But I want to play this clip from one officer explaining why they use them. And again, he's not talking about schools. He's talking about a regular police officer out in the adult world.
The taser has proven to be a tremendous tool because the officer and the suspect, neither are usually injured. You're not depending just on size and strength in order to arrest someone. Even a small statured officer against a larger individual can still have the taser as a tool to use to gain compliance.
So that sounds like they're saying that a taser will keep everybody safer in the adult world. How does that translate into a world where you're dealing with maybe a kid who's 60 pounds?
Well, I think nobody is denying that a taser is, safer than a gun, for example. But the lack of recognition of the potential for cardiac arrest, a lethal outcome with a taser, is where its deployment, its use becomes haphazard or, more. The regulations for its use become looser, and that's when tragedies happen. So for a younger person, a smaller person, as I mentioned, it's a higher risk because that current can reach the heart more directly and cause cardiac arrest. I might also mention that there could be underlying medical conditions that the child has, such as asthma or epilepsy or a heart condition that would raise the risk for a potentially traumatic outcome. So it doesn't directly translate to a child. And secondly, I think first and foremost should always be the recognition that a taser could be potentially lethal. And I've advocated that any police agencies using the taser should be trained in CPR or defibrillation, automatic external defibrillators, to resuscitate somebody should they have a cardiac arrest from a taser.
You mean even an adult?
Yes. I think that's very pragmatic policy. It's wise, and police are often the first responders to medical emergency anyway, so it would end up saving lives in that situation as well.
David, you told me a little bit about the effects that could be on the kid that gets tased, but what about other kids that see the incident? Is there also a possibility of trauma there?
Sure. Just like any other time that people see issues of violence, some people can be traumatized by it. Also, some people can be re-traumatized by it. And that can all, and there are potential issues of historical trauma as well, re-traumatization. If you're a young person of color and it looks like young people of color are being tased, that may raise all sorts of other issues as well. And I think it's important to, if I can add, understand that unlike being on the street, students are in school under compulsory education. And schools are communities in which you're trying to, enable people to learn together and work together. And the unnecessary use of weaponry, even non-lethal weaponry, unless, life is at risk, is an invasion.
And I should say that in the Huffington Post reporting, they describe incidents in which kids were shocked by a taser for mouthing off, for trying to run from the principal's office, and for getting into fights. Rebecca, you guys have documented that the use of tasers is on the rise. What kind of training do officers get before they're deployed with a taser?
So I can't really speak to how police officers train, how police departments train police officers in general to work with tasers. But what we do know is that it doesn't seem that they're getting any, most of the time, getting any additional training on what that means for being in a school and working with children. So whatever training that they get for dealing with street people on the street, hardened criminals, is likely also being applied to dealing with potentially young middle school students.
We have about a minute left, Rebecca. What are your next questions? It almost feels when I read this piece as though this is the beginning of investigation, not the end. What questions do you still need to have answered?
Yeah, so we really want to get a better sense of how often this is happening and who it's happening to. We don't know for certain if there's certain groups of students who are being tased more often. We don't really know if schools are doing anything to prevent this. And we don't really know if anyone's going to start tracking this. So we're really curious to see if we can get any more information on who this is happening to, where it's happening, what type of school it's happening in, and more of the why it's happening.
That is Rebecca Klein, education editor at The Huffington Post. David Osher is the vice president and institute fellow of the American Institutes for Research. And Zian Sang is a cardiologist and electrophysiologist at the University of California, San Francisco. Thanks so much to all three of you.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
This is a subject on which we would love to hear your opinions or experiences, if that's something that you have. Do you think schools should have access, or school resource officers should have access to tasers, and should they use them on students when the situation dictates? Call us and give us your thoughts on this. It's 404-500-9457 if you want to leave a message. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook as well. A fight between large students is a safety issue, says Sam Burnham on Twitter. That threatens the learning environment of kids more than taser to stop the fight. And then Vince Brown says cops and security should just go back to using batons, jujitsu, and bullets in high schools where students are as big as they are. What do you think? Send us your thoughts. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.